Who was Mr. William Cugett, and why do students of theosophy, especially at the Lodges, United Lodges of Theosophists, why do they meet every year to observe W. Cugett's Day? And why do we observe death anniversary at all, as a broad question? This is something interesting to consider. If you look at the cultures, right from Israel, Armenia, to the Far East, which is Japan, China, and so on, and covering broad spectrum of cultures like Cambodia, Russia, India, and so on, there is a long-standing tradition of observing the death anniversaries of either the ancestors or people who are revered. That's quite interesting, because we'll have to inquire why death anniversary. Generally, we consider death to be somewhat inauspicious. Observing the birth anniversary is more relevant, but why death anniversary? A few reasons we can probably guess. One is, it is a remembrance of the life that was lived by the person. And the impact that a person whose death anniversary we are observing, and how he or she has changed us or the society at large. So we remember his life events, his or her life events, and celebrate the life even after the person has passed on. The second interesting reason that we can probably find for this tradition is observing all the countries, Japan, China, India, Russia, Israel, and so on. One thing that is common to the ancient cultures of these nations is the idea of soul survival. That the person may be dead and gone, he may have left the body, but he's still there. There are various theories of what happens after death, explained in various ways of these traditions, in these traditions. But one thing is common, that they recognize a soul which is eternal and which persists after the death of the body. So celebrating the death anniversary is, in a way, saying or affirming this kind of belief that the body is gone, but the person whom I respected is still there. The third reason that we can draw is based on something that Madame Blavatsky says in one of her writings about gratitude. She makes a very mysterious, or rather profoundly occult statement, that the spirit of the teacher's letters or words cannot be understood except through the light of gratitude shining upon those letters or those words. In other words, she says that without gratitude towards one's teachers, you may study the book, you may study their works, intellectually try to understand it, but all that your mind will be able to grasp and withhold is just the husk and the letter only, but not the spirit of the teaching. So that, in a way, explains one of the reasons why the teacher, the guru, is seen as greater than parents who give the physical body, greater than all the gods. He is equated with Parabrahm itself in the shlokas that we recite. So the highest office is given to the guru because of various occult reasons, one of them being this gratitude. So death anniversary becomes another opportunity for us to show our gratitude towards our teacher. A final and the fourth reason that we can ascribe to this tradition is the people whom we respect and whom we consider as our teacher, their life is extremely important because it is not just their writings and the literature that they have left behind which matters to the true student, but the life itself is a message to, you know, use the words of Gandhiji when he was asked, what is your message? He said, my life is my message. So to study the life of a teacher is in a way an attempt to construct or reconstruct for oneself a certain kind of model code of conduct. Absolutely. To exemplify, they have set the example. So to know about their life is in a way an education in itself and an inspiration of sorts. So probably Mr. Judge himself would be quite disapproving of this last statement that was made, that we consider him as the model because knowing him or what we know of him through his various students, he was very humble and down to earth, and he despised people who would put him on a pedestal. You know, in the first letter that is published in the letters that have helped me, you know, he wrote innumerable letters to his students, his co-workers, and it was all compiled, or rather a portion of it was compiled and brought out as letters that have helped me. And in the very first letter, he says this to the recipient of the letter. He says, do not think much of me, please. Think kindly of me, but oh my friend, direct your thoughts to the eternal truth. Don't think of me, direct your thoughts to the eternal truth, but do not place me on any pinnacle. So this is an undercurrent in the life of Mr. Judge, which is expressed in various of his actions, the decisions that he took in concerning with Theosophical movement, Theosophical society, and so on, some of which is what we will consider in the course of the talk. He was born in 1851, April 13th of 1851, and his life was quite brief. It was about just 45 years, and the first 14 or even the first 21 years of his life, we hardly have any information or data to know much about his life, because he hardly spoke about himself or his background or things like that. But there is significant information that we can gather, such as he was born in Ireland, and at the age of 7, you know, he had a mysterious illness, and it was mysterious because the doctor actually pronounced the boy as dead, clinically dead. But a few moments after the pronunciation of the doctor, the boy revives. And there is a distinct change in the character of Mr. Judge pre the illness, which is the first 7 years, and post the illness. And the distinct change in characteristic was very significant and noteworthy, because nobody knew where he learned how to read, but they would find this young boy of 8 or 9 years who would be deeply studying books of Rosicrucianism, of spiritualism, of ancient philosophies, devouring them, whereas his own parents and the close family did not know how did he even get educated to read all these things? So the 7th year illness is something like a strange phase, after which there is a distinct change. Now, why that happened and what is the occult cause of it, we will not go into that. But there is, very interesting information that has been, that's available in the Theosophical Philosophy. And in fact, his whole life, following the cycles of 7 years, you can find that at the 7th year, there was a distinct change. At the age of 14, we find that they moved to USA, the father and the children moved to USA, the mother dies prior to that. And at the age of 14, a distinct change, because from Ireland, they migrate to United States of America. And at the age of 21, which is the next 7th year, he studied for law and passed the bar exam. And he went on to work under a person for specialized in commercial law. And he worked under the person who went on to become the Supreme Court judge of United States. And though this is a very short life that he lived, from 21st year to the 45th year, but this life is so full of lessons for us, and so much was done in that life, in those span of few years, that it reminds one of what Dhammapada says. Buddha says, better than 1,000 words poem of empty sounds is one stanza hearing which one feels peace, better than the life of 100 years of a man who perceives not the highest law, is the short life of a single day of the man who perceives the most excellent doctrine. And this verse, a student is reminded of when he sees the short life of Mr. Jett, who perceived the two doctrine and who sacrificed his life for making it available to others. And going further, we find that in 1875 is when he met Madame Blavatsky. That was when Madame Blavatsky, William Q. Judge, and H.S. Olcott, primarily the three, along with many others, formed officially the Theosophical Society. And if you look at the history of the Theosophical movement and read the letters that were exchanged during that time, the writings of the three important figures, we will find right from the beginning there were two distinct two distinct streams of thought or perspective towards what is Theosophical Society, what should it do, why is it founded, what is its purpose. So there were two opposing, almost diametrically opposite streams of thought right from the beginning, because Madame Blavatsky and Mr. Judge, having direct connection with the masters of wisdom, had a insight about the world, the needs of the soul, and what needs to be done to cater to the needs of the inner man, like we studied in the readings. And they saw the Theosophical movement as a dynamic moral movement to bring about the change in the mind and understanding of the people. And the Theosophical Society was seen as an instrument, as a vehicle through which this work has to be effected. Whereas if you read Colonel H.S. Olcott's writings from his old diary leaves of the time, 1875, when the TS was launched, he says that he saw the Theosophical Society as a society of occultists who would have large libraries of occult works and who would investigate into secret laws which is unknown to even the scientists. And his understanding of the Theosophical Society and its purpose was entirely different from the understanding of Madame Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. And this theme of this contrary views, one which is the original program of the masters, and the other which sees the society as an end in itself. One seeing the society as a means to an end, an instrument which has its place, but its place is way below and inferior to the movement, the moral and the spiritual movement, and the other as the society as an end in itself, which is an organizational and an intellectual effort. So that contrasting view, this theme with its variety, will be found throughout the history of the Theosophical movement from 1875 till date. And in its variety, you find it expressing in various events that happened. And this is important to understand many of the factors, many of the situations in which Judge was placed, and many of the decisions that he had to take. This is not a new thing, and this kind of contrary views, one sticking to the organizational or the entity of the world, the other seeing the spiritual, is seen in all religions, in all movements, because this follows a pattern which is there within the human constitution itself. One is the physical and the animal nature, with the lower mind working and the personal nature which wants things for itself. And man has his inner spiritual moral nature, which is all encompassing and which sees the personality, the body, the mind, the emotion, the psychic and the whole sensorium as an instrument for divine work. So this conflict which we find within ourselves, where, you know, we have the pricks of our conscience and where we make choices which are contrary to what our conscience says, this struggle is what we find in a large scale happening right from the beginning of the origin of the Theosophical Society in 1875. And moving on, if there is one book, if there is one work, one place where we can go to understand the life of Mr. Judge, it has to be the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita was a book which was very close to him, which he consulted all the time, and which he sought the principles of man and cosmos in the Gita, and applied the precepts of the Gita to every single problem, every single event, and every action that he had to perform, every duty that he had to do, was fundamentally based upon the precepts of the Bhagavad Gita. And this is something which in itself is a great lesson for us. And look at this. Mr. J.D. Buck, who met Mr. Judge in the winter of 1885, he says this about Judge. I met Mr. William Q. Judge in the winter of 1885. He was at that time a devoted student of the Bhagavad Gita. It was his constant companion and his favorite book ever after. His life and work were shaped by its precepts. That equal-mindedness or samatvam, and skill in performance of action, which is yoga karma sukaushalam, karma sukaushalam, skill in performance of action inculcated in this book of devotion and declared to constitute yoga or the union with the Supreme Spirit, Mr. Judge possessed in great measure than anyone I have ever known. His devotion never wavered, his anchorage seemed ever sure and steadfast, and herein lay his strength. His skill in performance of actions was marvelous, his executive ability of the highest order. He was never disturbed by passion or blinded by resentment, and when openly and strongly assailed or attacked, he held steadily on his course, working for one object of his life, which is the success of the Theosophical Society. This is what Mr. Buck who met Mr. Jetsch, who was a very close associate of Mr. Jetsch. As to Mr. Jetsch himself and his writings on the Bhagavad Gita, you know, when he started the magazine, The Path, in 1886, where he wrote innumerable articles, he, at the very first editorial of the first volume of The Path, he says this: inquirers ought to read, he says, true occultism is clearly set forth in the Bhagavad Gita and the Light on the Path, where sufficient stress is laid upon practical occultism. But after all, Krishna says, the kingly science and kingly mystery is devotion to the study, devotion to and study of the light which comes from within. The very first step in true mysticism and true occultism is to apprehend the meaning of universal brotherhood, without which the very highest progress in the practice of magic turns to dust and ashes in mouth. And this is a very significant statement, because at the time when the Theosophical movement was launched in 1875 and so on, there were many contesting ideas about the occult nature of man, his position in the cosmos, his nature, his relationship with other beings, and the various hidden psychic occult forces, which in the Indian system are called Siddhis and Iddhis, and investigation upon them and so on. It was quite a rage. It was quite a fashion to discuss these topics and to make investigations. And it was at this time that the Theosophical movement was launched with this particular objective, which is the first objective of the movement, that we need to form a nucleus of universal brotherhood, because it is only based on that nucleus that any subsequent progress and peace and happiness of all humanity is possible. It is not merely through dispersion of knowledge alone that happens, but knowledge based on an understanding of universal brotherhood. This was a very significant thing. And Mr. Jetsch himself, he writes in various of his letters to his students on how to use the Gita as a book, as a personal book for our application to daily life. He says, for example, inquirers ought to read the Bhagavad Gita. It will give them food for centuries if they read with spiritual eyes at all. Underneath its shell is the living spirit that will light us all. I read it 10 times before I saw things that I did not see at first. In the night, the ideas contained in it are digested and returned partly next day to the mind. It is a study of adepts, he says. Even the adepts study the Gita. And he says that one has to make a serious study of it and make it a foundation for one's thinking and action. In his writings on the notes on the Bhagavad Gita, in the very first section, if some of you may remember, he says this, that, you know, the Gita gives out various, there are various aspects to the Gita. It has its personal application, it has its application to cosmology, it has its application to astronomy, to the evolution of man and so on. But he says, as long as you are not ready to apply the precepts of the Gita to your own life, the book is useless for you. You better shut the book now, unless you are taking the next step, which is to apply the precepts of the Gita. So he was quite serious about this kind of study. And this is also, you know, found in one of his articles where he wrote, you know, if I were to train youngsters in the true education of life, in the true philosophy of life, I would not burden them with many, many books. This book, that book, go to library, take this book, study about this. What does this person say? What does that philosophy? I would not do that. On the other hand, rather my course of action, my course of education will be to confine the youth to the study of just the Gita and the secret doctrine, because all that we need is there within those two books. And I will confine the youth to only those two books for so long, such that the student will be able to write books by himself based on the metaphysical, you know, truths and ethical principles which are there in the Gita and the secret doctrine. So the youth must be able to apply the principles to practically every aspect of life, of society, individual, collective, and anything that he comes across or reads. He must be able to decipher, he must be able to apply the principles and decipher the truth from the false. And this is the education that I would give to you. So we need to understand the Gita itself to understand the life of Mr. Chesh. And and his translation of the Gita and the notes that he writes later, you know, in the translation, or rather what should we say as a recension or a rendition of the Gita, in the foreword that he wrote to that, he says that, you know, I do not pretend to, not the exact same words, but to the effect, I do not pretend to write any kind of commentary on the Gita, because an occult work of this nature can be commented upon only by an adept like Shankaracharya. And all that we can give is to give out the Gita itself, which is uncolored by our commentaries to the verses. And so Gita played an extremely important role, and if we study the life of Mr. Jetch, we find the application of Gita and the practical exemplification of the system given in the Bhagavad Gita. One characteristic of Mr. Jetch that we need to speak about here, two, three of them we will read, we'll consider and then close. One characteristic is he would outrightly reject any kind of external authority. He would never place his reliance on any external authority, and he would actively discourage his students from doing like that. He would, if any student would place his reliance or his judgment, suspend his judgment and place it on Mr. Judge or anybody else, Mr. Judge would get very upset, angry, so to say. And he would not be kind to such a person. And he would put the person back on his own base, on his own legs, and ask him to think for himself, choose for himself, decide for himself, and not make Mr. Judge a teacher, so to say, a guru who has to be followed blindly, or any external authority to be blindly followed. And that is the spirit of the Gita, because in the Gita, in the 18th chapter, we find a great avatar like Krishna, who gives the very principles of cosmos and man. At the 18th chapter, in the end, he says, Arjuna, now these are the principles. You choose as you want to do. He does not say to Arjuna that, Arjuna, I am telling you this, I am avatar, how can you know better than me? So you follow me. So this is a very important principle that we need to understand, because all true teachers make you rely upon yourself. If there is a teacher who is telling you to suspend your judgment and believe the teacher, or let go of your intuition and understanding and rationality and your sovereignty of moral choice, and place it at either the feet or the head of the teacher, then that is not the true teacher. He is not the true teacher, and he is not giving a true teaching. Because the very purpose of soul's evolution, which the Theosophical movement was launched to help, aid and support, the very purpose of soul's evolution is to become self-reliant. You know, a couple of Saturdays ago, we were studying in the same hall in the Echoes from the Orient, how even accepted disciples of the rishis, of the masters, of the hierophants, they are made to rely upon themselves and not upon the teacher And this is illustrated in so many ways. Take the life of Mr. Judge himself. In 1875, Theosophical Society was launched. By 1878, Madame Blavatsky had written her first magnum opus, Isis Unveiled, and she gave the book to the publisher and said that now I need to go to India. And she left to India. And Mr. Judge was practically left all alone for the whole of the American continent. And he was left to himself to decide the ways, the means, the methods of work, inaugurate it, sustain it. And the teacher did not come and say, okay, we have inaugurated this great theosophical movement, so I will guide you step by step, spoon feed you and show you where the pitfalls are, what to do. Nothing. He was left all alone. And we have a world picture of Mr. Judge during this time. Nobody in India, there was no, practically no Theosophical Society with any kind of members and all alone in his 20s. You know, imagine a person in his 20s who is married, who has commercial law, morning to night, through and through, he is burdened with work. And late night he has to come home, and deep into the night he has to write articles, he has to write letters, he has to do his study. So burdened with work, he did not have any leisure time, you know, to go to Theosophical, do Theosophical study. And he did all this all alone, and we have a world picture of him in the early days where he would go to the meeting place, nobody is there, the hall is empty, he's sitting all alone. And he does his readings, he does whatever the meeting was supposed to do, which is, if nobody is there, at least contemplate upon the ideas. And then he would systematically, punctually write in the minutes of the book that, such and such a thing was followed. These are the minutes of the meeting. And all the participants of the meeting were completely enthusiastic. So all alone, single-handedly, with a will which is undeterred by anything, he sustained the Theosophical movement, because the center of attraction was Madame Blavatsky with all her wonderful power, and she was a sphinx which had descended on in the 19th century, an enigma which could not be explained by anyone. And when she moved to India, all the attention moved along with her, all the sensation that could be there was not there. Only thing that was left was ridicule. But still, persistently, day after day, week after week, month and year after year, he pursued this with an undeterred will, and a will which is employed in this fashion certainly brings about results. And if a will is employed in this fashion onto these ideals, the effect that it will have, the changes that it will bring about is tremendous, as we find in 1880s and 1870s, when there was a huge wave of interest which grew after a prolonged period of Mr. Judge's almost single-handed work in the Theosophical arena. And we were talking of this in the context of him despising all external authorities. And, though he was a co-founder of the Theosophical Society, he was the vice president of the Theosophical Society, and he was practically the be-all and end-all of Theosophical Society in America, the whole continent. Yet, if you read his articles, you will find clearly he mentioning that do not take Theosophical Society also as an authority. The Theosophical Society must not be made into a cult. The Theosophical Society is an instrument which needs to serve its purpose. And the purpose itself is for each person to get knowledge of self, the knowledge of his spiritual nature, and employ this knowledge not for one's own liberation, one's own satisfaction, one's own scratch one's own intellectual itch or curiosity, or reach the masters of wisdom through this, but to use this knowledge such that, you know, the welfare of the human soul collectively, welfare of all sentient beings, the moral upliftment and spiritual welfare, that has to be accomplished, and Theosophical Society should not become another church. So this comes out very clearly in his in his writings. And if we look at the culture of work that he inculcated, it's the culture of work which we find in his life, it's absolutely inspiring. Probably it is his life and the sacrifices of Mr. Robert Crosby, and reading about their lives, it is probably this inspiration which has kept alive the United Lodge of Theosophists year after year, decade after decade, when wars have come and gone, World War I, World War II, economic changes, changes of government, so many changes, pandemics. At all times, the ULT has been kept running because of this kind of culture of work that Mr. Judge Crosby and Madam Blavatsky have inculcated. Look at this. He says, for example, that the true theosophical work is not about attendance. He says that merely coming to the Theosophical Society and becoming a member is not theosophical work. He was very clear of that, about that. Whereas the contrasting view that we find in H.S. Alcott, Besant and others is that this Theosophical Society is an end in itself. You know, they made it into a church, they made it into a cult following. Whereas the pure moral spiritual effort we find in the life of Mr. Chair. So he says that attendance is not what is theosophical work. And merely talking about theosophy and saying that, oh, it's a great philosophy and, you know, most useful philosophy, and great work has been done in the past and the students of the present, it's not mere verbal. There is a deep element of sacrificing for the sake of others, sacrificing for the sake of spiritual and moral upliftment of others, which is at the core of theosophical work, and one's personal life and the body of students with which a person is associated with, both becomes instruments for carrying out this kind of change in what he calls as the manas and buddhi of the race, or the mind and understanding of the race, which has been given a wrong bent, a wrong philosophy. That has to be rectified, and that is the true work. And he was extremely critical of mere intellectual theosophy. Intellectual theosophy. He was himself a great, he was a scholar of a different kind. You know, he translated the Bhagavad Gita, he translated the Yoga aphorisms, he translated portions of Upanishads that we find in his articles. With all his scholarly, sagely understanding, he was extremely critical of scholarly work for the sake of being scholarly. In other words, intellectual discussions alone, he was very critical of. And he says that what needs to be provided is, rather our primary work is with the masses, is with the masses. It's not with the scientist. It's not with those who can understand deep metaphysical and intellectual, disquisitions. The intellectual dissertations is not what is important, but what minister to the needs of the inner man, the common man is left high and dry, and his needs have to be attended to. And what is the common man burdened with? He doesn't know why he is here. We are all suffering, but we do not know why we are suffering. We see disasters around us. We see problems around us, but we do not know the cause of it, and we do not know how to solve them. personally as well as collectively, there is immense sorrow, suffering, but we do not know how to understand it and how to rectify it. A clear basis for thought and action is missing. Religion say follow ethics, but then the thinking, rational mind asks, why should I be good to others? Like our friend was the other day asking, how do I understand the higher nature? What is the proof of it? Right? And why should I follow good? I have my own life. I am quite satisfied with that. Why should I be good to others? Why should I practice charity? Why should I practice forgiveness? So Mr. Judge says these are the burning questions which needs to be answered, and they can be answered and have to be answered in the most simplest of the terms. And the work of the true student of theosophy is to understand the deep metaphysical truths such that it provides a logical, self-evident basis for ethics. Unless metaphysics translates into ethics, it is meaningless to have any kind of mere intellectual discussions for the sake of intellectual discussions. And this is the kind of culture that was set by Mr. Judge in his writings, and the culture which was followed further by Crosby in his writings and in his work. And it's a lesson for all of us. And look at this, Mr. Judge himself was a lawyer. And we have a lawyer friend here, and you know how, rather we all know, what is the kind of language that the lawyers use, which is more to disinform than to inform. And the language of the judicial system is to confuse and make you more and more, what shall we say, confounded, rather than come to the point. So Mr. Judge, though being trained a lawyer, and that too in commercial law, which requires a lot more care in terms of use of words, if you look at his writings or read his writings, you will find it to be utmost simple. Probably anybody who knows English will understand what Mr. Judge has written. It does not need terminology. It does not need any special understanding. The language is clear. The sentences are simple. The words that are used are commonly accessible. And yet it gives the profoundest philosophy that he lived, the philosophy of the Gita, the Upanishads, which are all derived from one common source. It was that philosophy which was shining through his writings. And how did he do that? Again, it comes to the question of the culture of preparation. You know, how do we prepare ourselves to engage in this work? It is said that he used to write hundreds and thousands of articles. You know, the articles that we have in the two volumes, is the first volume has about 170 articles. The second volume about 170 articles. And but those are not the only articles that he wrote. He would write innumerable articles every day, keep on writing. And after he would write, he would read them, see whether it would cater to the simple man's needs in this language that is simple, and he would just tear them and throw them away. It was an exercise that he would do to prepare himself. So this is the kind of work, you know, these are all some of the few things that we can learn from, because in the declaration we say that we are here to prepare ourselves to fit ourselves to be the better able to help and teach others. And we read about it every week, but what are we doing to fit ourselves to be the better able to help and teach others? Now, when we read Life of Judge, this becomes quite clear how to do that. And you look at two volumes, the volume 1, volume 2 have a clear split. If you come to think about it, the volume 1 is primarily dealing with the doctrine itself, the philosophy itself, but volume 2 deals with the application of the doctrine, the actual work that has to be done. This is quite indicative of Mr. Judge as a person, because he was, as his students say, we don't have the time, but we could have read some of the excellent thing that they say about his character. They say that he was a person, probably the only person who was a practical mystic. The practical mysticism is something very difficult to find. You will find many people who are very practical and pragmatic, but they have no idealism, no mysticism in their mind. They are purely pragmatic, great organizers. They can do wonderful things, but they have no idealism. Or a person becomes so idealistic that he is entirely disconnected from the needs of the people, the practicalities of the life, how to organize things. But a perfect admixture of practicality, pragmatism and mysticism is something that we find in Judge, in his life and his writing. That's another thing that we have to understand. He would never waste time. Morning to night he would have, evening he would have, burdened with work. He had to support his family. He had a small child. He would love children, but unfortunately the child dies at a very young age. And he has the whole burden of keeping the Theosophical movement and the organization of the Theosophical Society alive, up and running, with all that it takes to need to run a continental organization running, and suffer attacks. We'll come to that. We hardly have time. In one of his travels to South America, he contacted the Chagres fever, and it would give 20 years of time for a person to live. And before or on 20th year, the person died. That's what happened with Mr. Judge also. And with all this, innumerable attacks would come from within the Theosophical Society because of this clash of ideals, where a group of people would want Theosophical Society as an end in itself, whereas the Judge Blavatsky, Madame Blavatsky, would follow the original lines of the masters, which is to keep it as a moral, dynamic, spiritual movement with the society. So there were a lot of attacks that came in, which would actually affect him and brought down the number of years that he would live to just 45 years. So with all that, in the night, he would go home, write innumerable articles. He started the Path magazine in 1886. And for 10 glorious years, he wrote articles which are absolutely illuminating. The idea that comes to the student of Theosophy is, if Madame Blavatsky is the one who brought the Theosophical philosophy from the Himalayan range with a Bhagirath Prayatna, and the gush of the Ganges, which would flow through the parched soil and bring down any obstacle that is there in its path with a resistless force. If that was her mission, Mr. Judge's mission was to draw gentle channels from this Ganges and then form a simple network such that the Ganges, the pure water of the Ganges, would reach every single crop of the agricultural field. So Mr. Judge's writings are like a network and a channel from this river of Ganges. That's the feeling that one gets when he studies Mr. Judge. So he says that we have to come up with a Napoleonic propaganda, not in a wrong sense, propaganda not in the wrong sense, but he says that you have to be practically involved in the world and keep the work alive and not merely confine one's Theosophical study and intellection and effort to one's personal life. He says that is important, but that has its relevance only when you are working for the welfare of others. All the transformation, understanding of knowledge, he says that knowledge has to be acquired gradually and very carefully with a pure motive. And this, all this has to be done for the sake of the sacrifice and the work that we have to do for others. And in his last years, he suffered terribly because of the attacks that came in, the betrayal that came in from within the Theosophical Society. Yet he's all the time, when people betrayed him, were ungrateful for him, his only teaching was to his friends, followers and supporters, forgive them, forget them. They do not know what they are doing. Forgive them. And one lady was asked, Mr. Judge is such a great occultist. What is the psychic teaching that he gave you? What is the psychic occult teaching that he gave you? She answered, yes, there is a psychic teaching that he gave me, and the teaching is this: cast no one out of your heart, whether it is an enemy or friend, whoever it is. Do not close the doors of your heart to anyone, because understanding of the laws of karma, of the reincarnation, of the divinity in man implies that we have to forgive people and largely forget the wrongs that they have done to us and do good to the one who has done harm to you. And this he perfectly, he was not a talker. When the attacks came, when the trials came, like it happened in the life of Gandhiji, in all the life that he lived, brilliance. But the final test was in Naukali, when the communal riots were going on in Bengal, when India was burning. And that is where the most temptation comes, the most terrible trials come in that last moment, which we find in the life of Christ also, where when crucifixion is happening, what was the feeling that arose in the heart of Christ? So this we find in the case of Judge also. Probably it's a pattern that we find in all teachers, where there is a final test which will thoroughly test, or rather which will thoroughly bring out the true character of the person. And there, Mr. Judge was a resounding success, like we see in his writings and the way he dealt with his detractors. So we will close here, end here, with a debt of gratitude to our teacher for all that we have received from him, with an inspiration to practically work for Theosophical work, which we find so interesting. And we will end here with, you know, I told that he started The Path magazine in 1886, wrote for 10 years. Look at his impersonal view towards things. He was so impersonal that he would not use his name. He would come up with 30-35 different kinds of pseudonyms under which he would write articles. He would not sign everything with William Q. Judge. William Q. I wrote it. Innumerable. I actually went through all the articles and listed down. There are 30 pseudonyms. I'll just read a few of them and then we will close, because some of them also give an idea of the subtle sense of humor that underlies all the writings, many of the writings of Mr. Judge. He chose names like William Brehon. Brehon means actually judge in one of the Scandinavian languages. So he wrote under the pseudonym William Brehon. Eusebio Urban, Martanda, Brian Kinnivan, Ex-Asiatic, one of the staff, Haji Erin, Rodriguez Andiano, Harris P., one of the recipients, Ramesses, American mystic, Quilliam, that is William Kwan, Quilliam, and Dias Non. Dias Non means, our lawyer friend will say, is a judicial term, which means a day in which no judicial activity can be undertaken. So he is himself a lawyer. Probably when he wrote the article, he was not engaged in any lawyer, commercial law work. So he wrote under the nom de plume of D.S. Nom, Heronimum. And then he wrote it as a student, A.T. Mana, Maulvi, Kadi, Narayana Neelakanta, Zadok, Urban, Alpha, M. Moore, Pythagoras, Ramatirtha, J. Quilter, an obscure Brahmin. And the most funny of them is he wrote an article, addressing the spiritualists, who thought that they are actually, you know, with various practices, they can communicate with the spirit of the dead. And when they talk, they are actually talking to the spirits of the dead and get information from them and so on. He actually addresses them and explains what happens after death. You know, when we all die, what happens? What are the different principles of man? And how does reincarnation takes place? How do we understand the spiritualistic phenomena? He writes all this and signs it as an embodied spirit.